Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It is Wednesday, the 25th of February, 2026. With me today is Chairs Hoffman and Olson, and then we have Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Stedman. We have a full contingency today. We'll have two meetings today, one this afternoon dealing with the supplemental, but this morning we're going to have a discussion dealing with the permanent fund. And that'll be the single item this morning. We're going to have a presentation from Callan on the performance of that. So I'd like to go ahead and invite the Callan representation to come forward. Mr. Greg Allen, he's the CEO and Chief Research Officer, and Steve Center, I guess, the Chief Financial Officer. And they can introduce themselves for the record. Who they represent, they got a presentation to walk through. So the order of the committee will take questions if there's any at the end of the slide as you walk through your slide deck. So you can finish whatever thought process you have on that individual slide and just give me just a couple of seconds or something just to glance down the table to check the members. And they'll signal me if they have a question, and then I'll stop and we'll take care of that question and we'll move on. And if there isn't, we'll just go to the next slide. We also have Senator Giesel here also. I always forget to mention her, that she's here. She sits, I don't have a line of sight on her, but she's here paying attention also. So go ahead and take away. I'll watch the clock and make sure we're done on time, so okay. Don't worry about managing the time.
All right. Thank you, Chair Stedman. For the record, my name is Greg Allen. I'm the CEO of Callan. We've been the consultant to the Permanent Fund Board since we actually can't determine exactly when we started because it goes back so far, but in the mid-'80s, I think, we first started working. I've personally been working with the Permanent Fund since 1989. I built a model that we've used with the Permanent Fund to forecast the financial health of the fund over time and look at various things like asset allocation and so forth. So I'm here to sort of represent that component. Steve Center next to me is a senior vice president. He's also a lead consultant on the permanent fund account. Been on the account for
about a decade.
About a decade. And he typically talks about performance. And so today we're going to go through performance, give you guys an update on how the fund has been doing. We'll talk a little bit about the capital market projection process that we do for the permanent fund and how they come up with their asset allocation and what that should look like going forward. And then we were asked to comment on some perspectives on the draw, how much you can sort of safely pull out of the fund and have it be sustainable for future generations of Alaskans. And so we have some analysis on that as well, which we'll cover at the end. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Steve with the permission of the chair.
Mr. Center, I think I refer to you as Chief Financial Officer. I think it's Chartered Financial Analyst. Is that what that is?
That's correct, sir.
Okay.
So we're going to start on slide 4. This is just to set the stage for framing the performance of the permanent fund to help you understand how the capital markets performed through the end of 2025. So the next three slides are looking at benchmark performance for the capital markets, not the permanent fund's performance. I want to stress that. So you will see asset class performance here just to help you understand the drivers of the overall performance of the permanent fund. So starting on slide 4, we're looking at the public markets performance through the chair, Steve Center from Callan. I overshot that. My apologies. Starting on slide 4, we're looking at public market performance, so equities, fixed income, and cash. Last year, non-U.S. equities really drove performance. That green bar on the far left, non-U.S. equities had a positive 32.4% return. Much of that was driven by overall weakness from the U.S. dollar. When the U.S. dollar weakens, non-dollar currencies strengthen. That is a tailwind to performance for investing outside of the U.S. But overall company performance outside the U.S. did quite well, as did U.S. stocks. So while non-U.S. stocks were up 32%, the U.S. stock market was up over 17%. So continued strong performance from the U.S. stock market. And when you get out over longer time periods, 5 years and 10 years and beyond, you'll see that the U.S. stock market has been the key driver of performance for institutional investors, really over the last decade. The bond market, as we all know, interest rates went up post-COVID. When interest rates go up, bond prices go down. We've seen the Fed reverse here in last year in 2025. When interest rates go down, bond prices go up. So we saw the bond market return a positive 7.3% last year. But when you get out to that five-year period, that brown bar for the bond market, you'll see is still negative, a negative 0.4% return. And that's really driven entirely by the movements of the Federal Reserve with increasing and then now decreasing interest rates. Flipping ahead to if there's any questions?
Yeah, we'll take I got a question. Maybe you can define what the alphabet soup is?
Yes. Yes, thank you, Chair Stedman. So the alphabet soup in the top right, referring to the various benchmarks. So the Russell 3000 Index is the broad measure of the U.S. stock market, U.S.-based companies. MSCI ACWI ex-U.S. is the Morgan Stanley Capital International All-Country World Index ex-U.S., so excluding the United States. So this includes both developed and emerging market stocks. The Bloomberg Aggregate Benchmark is a broad measure of the U.S. bond market, looking at treasuries and corporate bonds and mortgage-backed securities. And then the three-month T-bill is just a simple measure of what you would get investing in cash.
Okay. And for those who are watching, we have the Russell 3000 Index, I think, as a selection in our SBS and deferred compensation accounts. So that you can cross-reference that if you'd like. I'm pretty sure it's the Russell 3000. There's a Russell 4000 also?
No, there's a Russell 2000,
okay,
which is
so that is the
subset.
3000 we have then.
Correct. Right. Moving on to slide 4. This looks at performance for the Moving on to slide 5. This looks at performance for the private markets. So in addition to investing in publicly traded securities, the Permanent Fund also invests in private equity, private credit, real estate, infrastructure, and a basket of hedge funds. And so we've pulled together some representative performance from various benchmark providers to show you what the performance has looked like in the private markets over the same time period as we looked at on the previous exhibit. So private market returns have been a bit more muted, particularly relative to the public equity space. You would expect things like private equity to outperform public equity over longer time periods because you are giving up liquidity and you need to be compensated for that. And we do see that when we look out over the full 20-year period, that private equity still outperforms public equity. Private credit, similar to private equity, when you are lending money to companies on the private market space rather than buying a publicly traded bond, you should be compensated for that risk, and that is also evident when you look at longer-term performance. However, we haven't seen the same sort of snapback post-COVID that we have seen in the public markets. What I will say is you have far lower volatility in these spaces because they just are not marked to market as frequently as the public market space is. You will see the one outlier on this chart is the real estate market. Post-COVID, there's been a lot of headwinds in real estate, not only from the increase in interest rates, but the move towards work from home has really impacted the office sector, and then the retail sector has really been impacted post-COVID as well. So these are two of the larger areas of the institutional real estate space, and they continue to struggle a little bit. We have seen signs of plateauing and a beginning of a recovery, particularly now that we've seen interest rates begin to come down again. I want to stop there for any questions.
Go ahead. Go ahead and continue.
So slide 6 just looks at those same benchmarks, but solely over that long-term 20-year time period. And this just helps illustrate how the private markets do tend to outperform the public markets over the long term, even with this near-term period where the public markets have done very well. When you look out over the long-term time frame, private equity outperforms public equity, private credit outperforms public bonds.
So I think on this, are you done with this slide?
Yes.
So I think on this, a few years ago, we were having some discussions with the Permanent Fund on the private equity side where the Permanent Fund was in that space earlier than most, leading to some pretty handsome returns, and they were cautioning us that going forward there will be more competition in that space and those returns are going to regress more towards the mean and they're not going to have the performance. So is that what has materialized? Or
I would say we are still fairly early in that game, but I'm sure this comment came from CIO Frampton. So I recognize Marcus Frampton's opinion, and we do agree that, first of all, your point, Chair Steadman, that the permanent fund was very early into private equity is very true. They have a very mature private equity program. They've been investing in these private companies for a very long time. It's one of the top-tier programs that we see in the public fund space. They also, as you've heard from CIO Frampton, he has been fairly vocal that he doesn't want to grow his public equity program as a grow his private equity program as a percentage of the permanent fund's assets, really beyond where it is, because for that same exact reason that you just said, that there's been a lot of dollars piling into that space. The spread that you can get between public equity and private equity has narrowed, and the overall benefit, therefore, from taking on that additional risk just gets smaller and smaller. So while they will continue to commit assets to the space, as the permanent fund continues to grow, they're going to have to still contribute and to the private equity side. They are not likely to grow it as a larger percentage of the permanent fund going forward, at least in the current environment.
Okay. Are there other questions on the slide? Okay, seeing none. Next slide, please.
The next slide is what Callan calls our periodic table of investment returns. It is a bit of an eye chart. The concept here is to help you understand the overall benefit of diversification, why we recommend and why most institutional investors create portfolios that are invested in not just public equity and fixed income, but also the private markets, because on individual calendar years, you cannot predict which asset class is going to be the top performer. It's very rare for you to see an asset class that is at the top of this individual calendar column 1 year and then is continually at the top of that column. So think of this as just a proof statement for why diversification matters. Slide 8 looks at the performance of the permanent fund as of the end of 2025. The permanent fund returned 12.5% last year, slightly ahead of its total fund target of 12.2%, and well ahead of the CPI plus 5 target. When we look out over the last 3 years, the permanent fund has lagged its benchmark by about 1.2%, but is still ahead of the CPI plus 5 target. The five-year period, with a 7.9% return, the fund outperformed its benchmark but slightly lagged the CPI plus 5. As a reminder, that five-year period includes that rapid rise of inflation that we saw post-COVID, which is not in that three-year number. When we get out over the longer periods, 10 years, 20 years, 35 years, the permanent fund has outperformed its performance target over all time periods and just slightly lags the CPI plus 5 over the trailing 20 years. So overall strong performance versus its performance benchmark. The performance benchmark is a blended, a weighted index of the underlying asset class benchmarks for the permanent fund, so a very good measure of how you would expect the fund to perform. And it's a good way to see how well the investment team has been implementing within its various asset classes. So by outperforming that benchmark over time, it's a clear proof statement that the investment team at the Permanent Fund has done a very good job of implementing their investment plan. Slide 9 looks at the Permanent Fund's performance versus strictly that CPI plus 5 target over the full 35-year period. So this goes back all the way past 1991. This includes three rather substantial market corrections: the dot-com bubble bursting, the global financial crisis, and the COVID epidemic. Even with those three substantial market corrections, the Permanent Fund has been able to exceed that CPI plus 5 target over the full 35-year period. But as you can see, by investing in the public markets and the private markets, there is volatility versus that CPI plus 5 return, which is very smooth. Unfortunately, there is no investment you can make that will give you CPI plus 5. If there was one, I would invest in it in a heartbeat. the only way you can really hope to meet that target is by creating a basket of investments similar to what the permanent fund has done.
So are you at some point in your presentation going to talk about where the 5% came from?
The CPI plus 5 target?
Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. It's been around a long time.
Yeah, we actually, through the chair, Greg Allen, we actually spoke about this at the board meeting Monday and Tuesday, and we're kind of going back through the history because we've talked about the CPI plus 5, and it has been one of the benchmarks that we look at going back to, as far as we can tell, the 2005 or 2004, but there were folks on the board or that were involved that thought that it may have gone all the way back into the early 90s. So I think just for the industry as a whole, CPI plus 5 is a return objective that if you invest in a diversified portfolio of stocks, bonds, and other things, I think generally the consensus is you have about a 50% chance of beating it. So if you think about a distribution of returns, good returns, bad returns for any asset class, people tend to focus on the middle, the expected return it's called, and the expected return of a portfolio like the permanent fund is right around CPI plus 5. So the industry's kind of coalesced around that as a long-term benchmark. It would allow you to spend 5% from an endowment, for example, and still keep up with inflation. So a lot of endowments out there use CPI plus 5 as an objective. I will say over the last 20 years, that has come down a bit. So I think when we look at the large endowments, they're kind of split. Some of them are still as high as 5. Many of them have moved to 4.5. If you look at the average target for an endowment these days, it's right around 4.65, 4.7. So that shows you that some of them are at 5, some are at 4.5. So I think it is a general consensus achievable target with a recognition that you're going to have about half the time you're behind it and half the time you're ahead of it.
And then at some point, I think you need to talk about how that's related to your asset allocation.
Yes, that'll be the next section.
Okay.
The next slide is the same analysis that we just did, but rather than looking at 35 years, we look at 25 years. So we lop off that first 10 years. This is just an illustration of how important the time period selection is. If you start running the clock in 2001, right before the dot-com bubble bursting, it looks like the permanent fund has not been able to keep pace with that CPI plus 5 target. So this is just an illustration to help you understand the importance of the time period that you choose and that you shouldn't we call it the power of cherry picking, right? You want to make sure you look at the longest term time period you can when you are evaluating performance. The next few slides compare the permanent fund's performance and risk characteristics versus two different peer groups, the first being Cowen's large public fund peer group, which is predominantly state-sponsored pension plans. The second is Cowen's large endowment and foundation peer group, which is large endowments and foundations. The reason we compare the permanent fund against two peer groups is twofold. The first being it's a unique asset pool that really doesn't have enough peers for us to create a robust distribution of returns to compare against. We really need north of 20 observations to make a decent peer group, and there's just not enough U.S.-based large sovereign wealth funds for all intents and purposes that we can compare the performance against. The permanent fund historically was more invested like a state-sponsored retirement system until about 20 years ago, early 2000s. At that point, its asset allocation shifted more towards an endowment and foundation model structured to support an ongoing payout. So comparing the performance against the two peer groups ultimately makes sense. It's kind of a tweener for all intents and purposes. It sits between the two. So we're going to start by looking at the large public funds on slide 11. You will see that over the last 3 years, the permanent fund has lagged other large public funds. The key reason for that is that most large public retirement systems have substantially more invested in the public equity market. We just saw how strong the public equity market has done over the last 10 years. That is the key driver of the reason why the permanent fund ranks in the bottom quartile versus large public funds over the last 3 years. Most public funds have about 45% in public equities. The permanent fund has about 32% in public equities, so substantially less. That being said, once you get out beyond 5 years, the permanent fund, even with that near-term underperformance versus public funds, 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years, the permanent fund is above median. So the 33rd percentile over the last 10 years, the 49th percentile over the last 20 years. That's the number in the little parentheses next to that distribution bar in the chart.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Senator, the weight to public equities is, you said, the biggest factor. Is the choice of equities a significant factor? My understanding is that most of public equity returns in the last couple of years have been driven by a very small subset of companies. Has the permanent fund chosen differently within that allocation?
Yes, to a degree. So, through the chair, Steve Senner again. What you're talking about is, in the U.S., there's been a key drive, the Magnificent Seven effect, right? The concentration of the S&P 500 and the fact that these seven large companies have really driven a large proportion of performance in the marketplace. Additionally, the U.S. up until last year was vastly outperforming non-U.S. stocks. The permanent funds public equity portfolio, like most active public equity portfolios of institutional investors, has been underweight to those Magnificent Seven stocks. It is very difficult for an active manager to overweight very large positions when they are as large as these Magnificent Seven stocks are. It takes a lot of gumption to say, I'm going to hold 8% of my portfolio in Apple. It's hard to do, but when it is that big of a portion of the index, that's the only way you can overweight a stock. So that factor that you mentioned has resulted in the permanent funds public equity portfolio slightly lagging the benchmark over that last five-year period. Additionally, the permanent fund is a little overweight non-U.S. stocks versus U.S. stocks. When you look at the market capitalization weighting, that was ultimately a tailwind last year with the strong performance we saw from the outside the U.S. That has been a systematic overweight that the permanent fund has had, both non-U.S. stocks and smaller capitalization stocks, which have lagged large cap stocks in the U.S. So you are correct that the underweight to public equity as a whole, the first factor I mentioned, was a factor to the underperformance over the last 3 years versus the peer group. But how the implementation has been done has also been a bit of a headwind. What I will say is that is not at all uncommon versus other large institutional investors. It is just very difficult to structure a public equity portfolio that is even market weight to these large holdings that have begun to dominate the benchmarks. We have seen some of that correct just in the last year. In 2025, only two of the Magnificent Seven stocks outperformed the S&P 500. So we've begun to see a bit of a correction to that overall impact.
Thank you.
And then on your slide here, 11, do you guys work with our pension plan?
I am a co-consultant on the retirement plan.
Okay. So I don't have those returns memorized, but I think the return on these are calendar years. It's not
so
an adjusted.
I actually have those numbers with me, so I'd be happy to, okay, to go through those.
So the calendar year return for the pension, a lot of times they use fiscal years, and we got to do conversions around here.
Yeah.
I think it's around 13%.
So the ARM board's return, this is for the PERS plan. So PERS and TERS are the same with their asset allocation. So last year, you can see at the bottom of that first bar, first column, the permanent fund returned 12.47. The ARM board, the PERS plan, returned 13.64, so slightly higher.
13.64.
And that's, again, they have more invested in public equities. So that's going to be one of those key drivers.
Okay.
What I will say is the 10-year number that you see here, the permanent fund is 9.02.
Mm-hmm.
The PERS return is 9.03. It's one basis point higher.
Okay.
So very similar return over the last 10 years, but it got there in a different way, right? A different asset allocation.
Okay. I think what we'll have you do at some point when we take a look at the pension plan performance. We'll have you populate this chart with that on there, plus the permanent fund. We also have another little portfolio, the Alaska Mental Health.
Yeah, correct.
Trust portfolio.
And I also work with Alaska Mental Health.
Right. So it would be nice to have those all put on one chart, okay, so we can get a feel for them collectively. And then their payout rate is lower. Alaska Mental Health is adjusting that. So there's some things that we'll get into later on in this presentation, but they're all kind of tied together.
Yes. Happy to answer that question.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, Chair. So the slight difference in performance indicates a different allocation. And if you could just, I guess your risk profile determines the allocation. So is there a reason for the different risk profiles and the resulting allocation? Is there some other driver for it?
A reason for the different risk profiles between the permanent fund and PERS?
Yes.
These are very different liabilities. Okay, the PERS plan is focused on a pension plan liability with a finite life. The permanent fund is structured to be a permanent fund and to last in perpetuity. So it's structured more like an endowment fund. Very different liabilities and risk profiles. We would not recommend that they be invested in the same manner.
Okay. Thank you.
I just wanted to highlight the driver for the allocation and then the resulting performance. Thank you.
Okay. Next slide.
Slide 12 compares the permanent fund versus our large endowment and foundation peer group. So again, this is endowments and foundations with assets over $1 billion. A very different return profile than you see from the pension plan universe, and that is because the endowment and foundation universe has far less in fixed income, far less in public equity than the public plan does, and far more in private markets, alternatives, things like private equity, private credit, real estate. The permanent fund has fallen into the bottom quartile over the last 3 years with this peer group as well, but again, over the longer time period, so even with that near-term lag, over the 10-year period, it is right below median, 9.02 versus 9.19%. And over the long-term 20-year period, again, just slightly below median. However, the risk profile you will see on the coming slides is actually slightly lower than most endowments and foundations. So it has been able to earn about a median return over the last 10 years with a lower risk profile than most peers.
Okay.
My final two slides look exactly at that, at the risk versus those same two peer groups. So slide 13 looks at the 10-year standard deviation and Sharpe ratio for the permanent fund versus large public funds. Standard deviation is a measure of realized volatility, so just how volatile the returns have been over that 10-year period. You'll see that the permanent fund falls into the bottom quartile versus large public funds. It's had a far less volatile return pattern, and that is, again, because it has less invested in the public markets. Public equities and public fixed income are inherently more volatile than the private markets. Sharpe ratio is a measure of risk implementation. Think of this as a return per unit of risk, how well the risk that is being taken is resulting in positive performance. And the Sharpe ratio for the permanent fund over the last 10 years is very much in the top quartile. So the investment team is taking measured risks that are paying off well compared to the other peers in this peer group.
And do we have a center ratio?
I wish.
Sharpe was an actual person.
Yes, he was. Sharpe was indeed an actual person.
Nobel Prize winner.
Yeah. I was just checking them.
I am sadly not a statistician by trade. Economist, but not a statistician. Slide 14 does the same analysis versus the large endowment and foundation peer group. So you'll see that, the standard deviation is below median, but not as far down in the distribution as we saw versus the public fund peer group. But it is still above median on the Sharpe ratio side. So again, a slightly lower risk profile than most endowments and foundations. And the implementation of those risks that are being taken continue to be positive versus the peers. I want to stop there for any questions we have about performance before I pass things to Mr. Allen.
Do you have any questions? Okay, we'll go on to the next section.
Can I take that keyboard from you? Thank you. For the record, Greg Allen. So this next section, we're going to talk a little bit about asset allocation. Asset allocation is the exercise that every big institutional investor goes through to decide which asset classes to invest in and how much to invest in each one. And that becomes the strategic plan and the roadmap for how the staff and all of the managers that work for the fund implement the program. So we go through this process every year. We take a look at the asset allocation for the permanent fund. On an ongoing basis, staff will make recommendations to the board to adjust it. Usually it's a 1% move here, a 1% move there. And we help to evaluate what that might look like going forward. So this is a little bit of an exercise of looking out into the future to understand asset allocation at the permanent fund. So the foundation on slide 16 of this process is that we do capital market projections. So Callan, we're in this business. We do this for hundreds of clients. Every year we use the same expectations for every client. So we have a team that gets together and essentially forecasts the return for the next 10 years, the risk or the standard deviation, and then the correlation, which measures the interaction of these asset classes. So correlation is actually a very important number. When two asset classes have a low correlation, that means one zigs, the other zags, and when you put them together, this magic thing happens where you get a little more return and a little less risk. So that's at the heart of asset allocation and building portfolios. So we've been forecasting these things for a long time. We do it every year. We use the numbers with every client, and so we're going to show you what the permanent fund looks like in that context with a little bit more background. All right, on to the next slide. These are our capital market projections for all of the asset classes that the permanent fund is currently invested in. And at the very bottom there with the little orange circle is the expected 10-year return annualized for the permanent fund going forward, 7.3%. So that's the headline number. Notice that inflation is 2.5%. So it doesn't quite get you to 2.5 plus 5. And we'll talk a lot about that going forward. We've done this for years and years for the permanent fund. Sometimes their expected returns above inflation plus 5. Sometimes it's below, just depending on what we think the capital markets are going to be able to deliver. The only other thing I would have you take away from this chart is that the permanent fund is an extremely well-diversified portfolio. Every one of those line items is a big portfolio that's being managed independently and well. And then when you put them all together, you get the permanent fund. So it's a complex portfolio. It's a $90 billion portfolio. I'd say it's one of the, in my view, one of the best-run portfolios amongst our clients. All right. This is just a graphical representation of all of those returns that were on that previous page with risk. So risk is on the y-axis or the horizontal axis, and return, expected return, is on the vertical axis. And the idea here is to show you two things. One, if you want more return, you have to take more risk. You can't have high returns and low risk. The capital markets just don't let you do that. So the other thing to say about this chart is if you look at the permanent fund portfolio dot, it's above almost all the other dots but with less risk. That's the power of diversification. When you mix U.S. equities with U.S. fixed income and hedge funds and emerging market debt and all those little building blocks, you get this kind of magical property where because they offset each other over time, the risk gets reduced and you still are able to achieve the high return. So our whole goal when giving advice to clients and pretty much the goal of every institutional investor is to be in that place. It's we call it the efficient frontier, where you're getting the most return for that amount of risk. And then you just have to decide how much risk you can afford to take. All right. This is our little report card on ourself. So these focus you on the orange line and the green line, or I say that teal, I'll call it teal or aqua. This is just showing you back, so I'll take the first dot. This is 1989. This was the first year that I was involved in the capital market projection process at Callan, or responsible for it. We take a portfolio made up of equities, fixed income, and real estate, 60-30-10, so a kind of representative portfolio. We put our expectations in there, and we come up with a number. So at that time, we thought that portfolio was going to do about 11%. Then we wait 10 years, and we see how we did. And if the orange dot is on top of the blue dot, that means we got it exactly right. If the blue dot's below the orange dot, it means we guessed too high. And if the blue dot's above the orange dot, we guessed too low. So I had beginner's luck. My numbers were actually perfect in that first year. But you can see you can't always get it right. It's a hard thing to do to forecast the future. I'd point to 2008. We're back in 1999. We had no idea we were going to have a dot-com bust and a global financial crisis all in that one 10-year period. So, of course, the blue line was well below the orange line. We guessed way too high back in 1999. But this is just sort of to give you some maybe confidence that these numbers that we're coming up with are pretty reasonable. I would also say that our projections have generally come down. So back in 1999, interest rates were a lot higher. So it's been harder and harder to earn the same return over this time period. All right, I'm going to skip this slide because there's just a lot and I don't need it. This is the permanent funds asset allocation. So you can see that 20% in public fixed income, 32%, as Steve referenced, in public equities, which is a global equity portfolio, 18% in private equity, 11% in private real estate, 10% in infrastructure and private credit, and 7% in the hedge fund or absolute return category, and then some cash and a category called tactical opportunities, which is 1% of the portfolio designed for sort of the CIO to, if he identifies a market dislocation, he can invest in the team, can invest in opportunities. But if they don't have any great opportunities or ideas, it's generally just invested in the S&P 500, which is what most of it is right now. So this has a 7.3% expected return, and we estimate the probability of beating 7.5% or inflation plus 5 to be a little under 50%, about a 47% chance that it's going to beat it over the next 10 years. All right. I think I'm just going to – I'll show you – all right, so this is actually an important slide. So I'm flipped ahead to 23. That blue line – is what we call the efficient frontier. That's the, using our expectations, that's the most return you can get for each level of risk there. The green dot is their current portfolio. It's right on the line. The orange triangle is if you just implemented with public stocks and public bonds. So it's a very simple portfolio. You could index it. You could buy it with a click of the mouse. You can see that it has a lower expected return and the same level of risk. So I wanted to pick a portfolio that has about the same risk as the permanent fund, but something that you could go back and look at a really long time ago. Private equity didn't exist in 1939, at least there was no index for it, right? So you can't go back very far with the private markets. But I wanted to take a 70-30 portfolio, and if I can move to slide 23, illustrate how it did relative to a 7.5% return over time. So the orange line, so each point on the blue line, let's say that, is the 10-year trailing return. So it's the return for the previous 10 years for a 70-30 stock bond portfolio. This goes back to 1926. The orange line is 7.5%. So you can see 65% of the time or 64% of the time, the blue line was above the orange line. So it's doable. You can beat 7.5%. But there were some periods where it was substantially below. So at the end of 08, global financial crisis plus the dot-com, both in there for that 10-year period. You can go back to the 73, that should say 74, oil crisis. That was a terrible period for stocks. It took 10 years to recover from that. The Great Depression all the way back in 1929, that's that first starting point. So when you have these big global financial events, the odds of beating inflation plus 5 go way down. So, and that's just something you have to accept as a long-term investor. And there's going to be a period in our future where the permanent fund, which provides 66% of the state budget, is going to be well behind CPI plus 5. That's just the nature of investing. So get ready for that. Hopefully it doesn't happen on your terms, but it has happened before, and I can tell you it's an uncomfortable, and you know, it affected the dividend in the past. Now it affects the state budget, so it's, there's some gravity to it.
We'll hold you responsible if anything goes
wrong. Thank you. All right. I'll be in California, by the way. All right. I'm going to skip through these slides because I don't think they were in there just in case some questions came up and we didn't need them. So that's asset allocation. I'd stop here for a second if there's any questions about the permanent fund and why they invest and what they do. And
Senator Cronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just got a question because a lot of people out there are like, how come we just don't invest in S&P 500 and call it good? Could you explain to the public out there, that's, if there's anybody listening, of why we don't do it that way?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. First of all, you'd be the only one in the world doing it that way. So it's great when you're the only one in the world doing something and you're right. It's much tougher to hang on when you're wrong. The reason you don't do it that way is because you lose all that diversification. So the S&P 500 has been an amazing investment for the last 7 years, 10 years, basically except for 2022, every year since the global financial crisis. It has benefited, I would say, primarily from the Magnificent Seven, sort of those technology companies. They represent, I think, they represent about 35% of the index now, something like between 35 and 40% of the index. So you're basically taking, you know, $90 billion and investing 35% of that, so call that $30 billion in 7 stocks. That's what you would have if you're invested in the S&P 500. There's no planet on which that's considered diversified in the institutional investment world, and you'd be subject to massive criticism when the piper has to be paid and the entire portfolio goes down 40%, which is what happened to equities in the global financial crisis. So you got to have bonds in there because you just can't absorb that much volatility. That would wipe out the ERA. You would not be able to pay anything out of the fund under the current structure. So you can only afford to take a certain amount of risk in a fund like the permanent fund. I mean, there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacks out there. We get this like all across our client base. Everybody's sitting in your shoes and the permanent fund shoes. How could you be so stupid? You could have just indexed this thing in the S&P 500. This is a very unique moment in time where one asset class outperformed by that much. And we didn't know back in 2020 that it was going to work out that way. I mean, people thought, I can remember in March of 2020 when COVID hit, and people were thinking it was the end of the global financial system, right? And if you were all in stocks, you took the full brunt of that. So you got to have bonds. The private markets, why do they include private market portfolios in there? Again, that's been a great area to invest over the last 20 years. It's returned double-digit returns. A lot of companies these days don't go public. And if you don't invest in the private markets, you can't invest in these great companies. So, again, the permanent fund is reaching out. You know, it went from being, if I think about the history of the permanent fund, it was built off of one commodity, oil. And now it is a globally diversified renewable resource that's invested in just about everything that generates a return. And I think that, at least in our investment finance world, that power of diversification, you're never going to be the top performing thing because you're not 100% in the thing that does the best. But if you're in them all, you're going to have a smoother ride. And, you know, if you do it right, you're going to be able to earn, you know, competitive returns. It's what the permanent fund has done. So I would argue that it would be completely irresponsible for a large institution publicly. It's the public's money. To put it all, put 35% of it into 7 stocks. Sounds great. And maybe that works out. You could have put it in crypto. If you bought Bitcoin, you'd been up a lot more than if the S&P 500. Or if you just bought one stock, NVIDIA, you know, you'd have $900 billion, right? So, yeah, there are better investments in hindsight. But looking forward, you know, safety first, and try to earn a return along the way. So that's my view, at least.
Yeah. Go ahead. Through the chair, Steve Center, I just want to add one more comment. The Uniform Prudent Investor Act has a requirement to diversify, a duty to diversify. So investing only in one asset class, and in particularly, as Greg alluded to, investing 35% of your portfolio in seven names, that flies in the face of the duty to diversify. So, and also for the record, we do not recommend buying only one stock like NVIDIA, just for the record. Thank you.
Thanks for reining me in there, Steve.
Senator Keel.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the same topic, it's a good discussion. Excuse me. Can you talk also about how that compares to the fees and the costs? Because the diversification does bring higher costs, and especially in the private markets. So can you talk to us about how that balances with the returns and the volatility?
Through the chair, Greg Allen. First, thank you for that question, and I know it's a hot button, because not only could you have gotten the highest return by being in the S&P 500, but you could have done it for like one basis point or something like that through an index fund. So we get both of those an awful lot. First off, the performance that we report out to you and to the permanent fund for the permanent fund is all net of fees. So all the fees have been taken out of there before we calculate the return. I mean, they affect the return. They drag the return down. The public markets, you can implement much more cheaply than the private markets, and that's just a fact. Private markets are more labor intensive. The fee structures are what they are. So I'll start with the public markets, though, first off. Well, I want to make the general comment that because of the permanent fund's size and position and philosophy, they have some of the lowest fees in every asset class of any investor. So they have amazing negotiating power, and they've used it to their benefit effectively over the years. So their overall cost structure, given the asset allocation that they're in, is as low as it's going to get, as low as they can get it, all right? And it is low relative to other funds, particularly smaller funds, who don't have the power to negotiate. In the investment management world, particularly on the public market side, fees are quoted in basis points, but as your asset size get bigger, they ramp down. And so the permanent fund has the power to get to the bottom of what we call the fee scale for most of the products that they're in on the public markets. On the private market side, there's not as much ability to negotiate fees, and that's for one simple reason. The best private equity managers are completely oversubscribed, and they are typically not only are they the best in the past, but they persist. They've got a business that allows them, you know, they're the first place that people are going to go when they want private equity money. Right, so they just get better deal flow. They've got better organizations, and it's statistically clear that there's persistence in the private markets. In the public markets, it's more difficult. You know, the top performing active manager is not always the same manager, but in the private markets, so it's a little bit of a. There's no pressure on fees for these guys, because if the permanent fund walks away and says, "I don't want to pay 2% management fee and 20% carried interest," which is the going rate, they'll simply say, fine, because we've got 20 other investors behind you. And if you look, you know, the permanent fund has to put out about $1 billion a year into private equity just to keep up, because they're getting money back from all their previous investments. To keep it at 18%, they've got to keep committing capital. And we just heard an analysis of their last 6 months of what they've been able to do, and they wanted to commit, I think, I don't remember the exact numbers, but call it $600 million over that period. And they were only able to do $400 because the managers turned down $200 of their $600, right? So this is what they're up against. You just don't have fee negotiating power. So if you want to be in private equity, if you want to be in private credit, if you want to be in private real estate, there's a going rate, and it is higher than managing a public equity portfolio, which has been so automated. And those fees have come way down. So if you go back.
So let's go on. Okay. Because what I want to make sure is we get through the presentation.
Yes.
And then we can come back and go into some of these other subject matters, because I think what's coming is is important, and it's a subject matter which the committee is going to is planning on taking up.
Okay.
And then we can come back and we'll finish up the questions. And but I'm just watching the clock. I want to make sure you guys don't have to come back.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We appreciate that. All right. All right. So I didn't know exactly what people were going to want, but I had a lot of tools at my disposal and some time. And so I've put together a bunch of charts on the draw because I know it's a big question. I actually think it's the seminal, fundamental question for the state of Alaska. There's a debate about the two-account, one-account. To me, the most important thing that you can do is to set the draw, ideally constitutionally, at a sustainable level so that there's not this mystery around what's going to get appropriated every year. So I think the draw is way more important than whether it's a two-account or a one-account system. So I'll put that out there first. So what I wanted to do was look at the draw from various perspectives, and by the draw I mean the percent of the corpus or the percent of the fund that you're taking out each year. I'm going to go back and look at it as if you moved to a POMV back in 2000. So I'm going to look at the past and just overlay the returns of the fund on that and the statutory returns of the fund. I'm going to evaluate a couple different rates of withdrawal. And then I'm going to look at that kind of looking out into the future. So that's what I'm planning to do. So with that, I want to level set here to make sure everybody understands how the draw works now. So the formula is they take the average of the market value at the end of each fiscal year for the last 6 years. They take the first five of those 6 years, and they take the average, and then they multiply that by the draw rate. So in this simple example, I took the time period from the end of 25 back to 2020. So you take the average of 2020, 2021, 2022, 2023, 2024, you get 76.4, okay? Now the fund value as of 2025 was 85.1. So the average is below the fund value, and that's normally the case because the market value of the fund is generally going up. So what that means is that when you apply 5% to that trailing average, you don't end up with a 5% draw. You end up, in this case, with a 4.5% draw relative to that $85 billion. So I think that's important to know and why that's important. The longer the look back, the lower the effective draw, right, if we went back another 5 years and took the average. So that's one of the variables that's in your control. The nice thing about this formula, I think there's two nice things. One, the average moves around a lot less than the market value does, so the draw is much more stable. Again, if you did a 10-year, it'd be even more stable. The second thing is that operationally, we know what the draw is going to be at the end of 2024 for 2026. So that's a nice feature. I remember back when the dividend, they used to have this big meeting where they'd announce the dividend, and you know they were literally calculating it up at the last minute before the meeting because you know they based it on the end of the year, right? So they were smart enough now to look back a whole year. So this is a good formula. I have no problem with this formula. The most important input is that 5%. Is it 5? Is it 4.5? Is it 6? And so that's what we're going to look at. Any questions on
current? Senator Hoffman.
Can you go over the time when the state first started the draw? That was through a Senate bill that this Finance Committee passed, Senate Bill 26.
In 2018?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this next slide might be really good for that.
Prior to that, the legislature never touched the permanent fund except for dividends.
The dividend.
Yeah.
All right, so you set me up perfectly, Senator. This shows the history of the draw as a percentage of the fund's ending market value. So it seems to move around a lot. Much of the moving around is because it's a percentage of the ending market value, which moved around a lot. But up until 2018, you used to have the formula for the dividend, right? It was, you know, half of 5% of the previous 5 years' statutory net income. It was a lower draw. It averaged 2.3% over the period from 2000 to 2018. That was a beautiful period for appreciation of the fund. That's why you can pay $3.8 billion out of this fund right now. If you had been taking out 4.4%, which is what it's been since 2018, and I'll show you this later, the amount you'd be able to pull out now would be a lot less. Okay, so if you take anything away from this, the less you take out, the more you'll have for the future. There'll be a lot of that. So anyway, I just wanted to level set how big of a change it represented moving from the history up till 2018. You basically doubled the amount that's coming out on average.
Okay, when you go to the next slide, you're done? Okay, before you go there.
Sorry.
Back before we did the 5% draw, we did half of the calculated statutory net income, which was distorted by, in the last few years, some big real estate sales.
Yep.
Take that and set that issue aside. But the state reinvested their 50%. We never took it out. Mm-hmm. And that allowed the permanent fund to grow substantially higher than it would have been if we would have taken our half out and paid the other half in dividends.
Yeah.
So there's that little adjustment. I know it gets lost, and when you talk to the public, they look at you like you're from Mars when you tell them that. But that went on for decades.
Yeah.
That helped build that.
Yeah. I mean, you probably already know this, but the permanent fund in the United States is like a miracle. This did not happen in any other state. Nothing close to this. The amount of savings that you have per citizen here is just, it's fantastic. So,
right. And we're going to make it bigger. So you can continue your presentation and show us how to do that.
All right. So what I did here, this is stay with me on this, okay, because there's a lot going on here. I went back and did what I call a historical simulation. I said, let's go back in time to 2000, because I have data going back that far, on all the things I needed. And I'm going to take the actual return for each year of the permanent fund. I'm going to take the statutory return, so I knew what that was, you know, how much statutory net income got generated. I'm going to overlay the two-account system. All right, so I've got the ERA. That's my limiter. I can't spend more than the ERA. But I'm going to overlay a 5% draw rule. Same rule, first five of the last 6 years' market values. And I'm going to look at what would have happened. Okay.
You want to mention inflation proofing?
I do want to mention inflation proofing. Inflation proofing has been a little bit of a lumpy process in actual history, and that's at the discretion of you all, and so you can use that tactically. You know, don't do it when it's dangerous to do it. But what I did is just said, if there was money left after the draw was paid, and inflation was 2%, you'd pay as much of 2% as you could. Right, so I just assume that you followed the sort of the statutory formula for inflation proofing here. In fairness, that didn't always happen in the past, but I didn't want to overlay that kind of lumpy inflation proofing in here. I could have done it either way, and that's why this is a model. I'm not saying everybody would have done it this way because it had consequences. All right, so the orange bars are just what the formula would have said. So if it was a one-account system, that's what you would have paid out, is the orange bars. The blue bars are what you were allowed to pay out based on the ERA limitation. So in every year where the blue bar was lower than the orange bar, you didn't have enough in the ERA to pay the full draw. So not surprisingly, right after 2008, 2009, you wouldn't have been able to pay a draw at all under the 5% rule. You'd have gone from whatever that is, $1.5 billion in 2008, down to zero in 2009. That would have been a tough year. I don't know what the price of oil was doing. But this shows you that the current system, the current two-account system, if you follow all the rules with inflation proofing, you're going to run into periods inevitably where you can't sustain a 5% draw. It would have happened in 04, 09, 10, 12, 13, 14, and 24. None of them were as bad as 09, but 09, 10, 2010, you'd only been able to pay about half. An important thing about 2009, 2008 was so bad that it basically wiped out the ERA. Not only that, but over the next year, just normal day-to-day activity of the permanent fund, they're selling stuff, they're buying stuff, they're realizing losses. And when you realize losses, it's a negative in the statutory net income. The statutory net income in 2009 for the permanent fund was negative $2.9 billion. So that did not recharge the ERA. That actually contributed to it getting smaller. So your existential risk is the two-account system when your state is so dependent on the permanent fund. And that's why I think the trustee paper came out and said, hey, we're going to do our best to generate what we can, but we can't control the two-account system. Importantly, another important thing I would note about this analysis, looking back, is that if you go back to 1999, 2000, 2001, there was a philosophy, I think, among the legislature that, you know, there's plenty of statutory net income. We just don't want to leave anything in the ERA because then the legislature can spend it. So there were appropriations, ad hoc appropriations, at least three of them during that period, where they took more than inflation proofing, just so there wouldn't be a balance in the ERA that would tempt the legislature. So they kept it tight. Right now we've got a pretty healthy ERA relative to history. And I know people are worried about that because at any point in time you could take it all, right? But a healthy ERA at the beginning of this would have allowed this to be much more smooth than it was. We started out with an ERA balance of, I don't know, it was like $200 or $300 million back in 2000. So there's a lot there. I'll stop with questions for questions.
Senator Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Allen, you show that that ERA would have been a limiter and reduced the draw in half a dozen years. How much? Are we talking about a difference of $10 billion or $20 billion? I mean, it's a 25-year period. What would have been the difference in the total draw?
The cumulative difference in draw? I brought you. That would have been a good thing to put on there. Hang on a sec. I can kind of do the math here. 1.5, 4.5, 5. Between 5.5 and 6 billion.
Okay. So just to follow up, so that cumulative draw number on the top, 41.2, I don't...
That's the blue bars all added up.
Okay.
So the orange bars would have been probably 47.
47. Thank you.
Yep.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Mr. Allen, some of the critics of White Paper 10, of the recommendations of White Paper 10 that can join the funds, and they allude that somehow it's an intent to, like, overdraw the fund or somehow get at the corpus. In other words, the idea that the corpus has been protected, we've been limited to the earnings reserve, and that somehow that recommendation presents a risk to the fund, so that the argument has been that we need to avoid doing that because that risks the fund. Can you just comment on the logic or any possible considerations of that? And do they have a point, or is there something that folks are missing as they consider that White Paper 10 recommendation?
Through the chair, I see the point. And I have a couple comments. First of all, even under the two-account system, principal was effectively invaded in 2009. The fund value fell below the value of the principal. Okay, so just because you have a two-account system, you can't protect against the markets invading principal. Okay, that's second comment. Principal is an accounting number, right? It's kind of this ledger that you add to every once in a while, and you add the oil revenues to it, and I think it's become a sacred cow up here, so I understand that. But I think the point of it was to not invade the sustainable nature of the endowment, right? To me, and I said this at the beginning, the two-account system is a clumsy way of doing that, in my opinion, right? It works, sort of. You know, as long as you keep doing the inflation-proofing appropriations that you're supposed to. But it comes at the cost of potentially, with a 5% draw, a year where you have nothing. You can't pay anything out. And I think that's going to put a huge stress on the system, and you're going to change the rules. That's my guess. To me, what everybody else does to create a durable corpus is pick a rule, stick to the rule. Don't leave it up to the legislature this year to decide how much to appropriate from this ERA. They can only get 5% of the first five of the last 6 years, or 4.5% or 6%. The rule itself would preserve the principle. As long as you pick a sustainable draw. You know, it's like a fishery. If you take too much out in 1 year, you're going to eat your own seed corn, right? So in the rest of the endowment world, rather than this, what I would call antiquated system that's based on realized gains, which are, you know, it was a good idea when 100% of the money was invested in bonds. You know, it kind of fit the mold. But now with this globally diversified portfolio, it's kind of outlived its application. And it's going to create, I mean, I hope not, but the best thing you can do under the two-account system if you want to preserve the stability of the draw is to never inflation-proof. But then you've got this tempting giant pool of money that when something goes horribly wrong or you want to invest in a liquefied natural gas pipeline or whatever it is, look at that. You know, we could take that. And it's just a majority vote, right? So the safest thing to do would just top up the ERA. And then you never hit the limit. But then that money's vulnerable. So I don't think the point of the one-account system was to give the legislature the ability to appropriate everything. It has to come with a constitutional limit on how much you can pull out in any 1 year.
So you're looking at the bad boy and girl committee that put billions and billions into the corpus to prevent that very thing from happening.
Right.
We even had a Scribner error 1 year because we had no support from the governor. And there was constant requests to the committee to overdraw the permanent fund from the administration, from both political bodies, parties, groups, and some members in each of the House or the Senate. So this committee has been very defensive of the permanent fund, knowing that there's this potential inherent risk of not having enough liquidity for the 5% draw. And we had those conversations last year with the permanent fund expressing concern of their illiquid investment waiting, that we are their customer or their client.
Right.
They got one. That's us for 5%. And we need to meet that obligation. So we have taken a fairly aggressive stance in protecting the permanent fund here. And we're having preliminary discussions with the permanent fund now on the next inflation-proofing number and how to package that up to try to have some form of a relief valve in case things do move against the state in the financial markets, recognizing that there's a risk there. There is a definite interest in protecting the principle of the permanent fund. And we used to have pretend checks up here on the wall. One was $4 billion and one was a little over $4 billion. And we have a running discussion with the permanent fund that they're, because we didn't, on the first one, didn't put the language in for inflation proofing.
Right.
Because there was some marketing maneuvers, political maneuvers, to get that check over the line into that account. So, and we've actually put in some language in last year's budget, reinforcing that to the permanent fund. Those funds, that over $8+ billion, was directed for inflation proofing. Mm-hmm. And when we keep a running total if we're ahead or behind.
Yeah.
So we recognize the thief in the night, and we want to make sure he stays in Lemon Creek. That's our local prison.
All right.
Okay. But we'll go on, because I think this is really important.
Yeah. I just did that same calculation of what was actually put in and what would have been, and you're very close to having fully inflation-proofed, by the way. I did the exact same thing. I just took the draw down to 4.5% just to show you the impact of that. And you can see that 2009 and 2010 were still tough. There was a little bit of a drop in 2013, but it met the draw in every other year. So the two-account system, I think, is probably a little better tuned to a 4.5% draw than it is a 5% draw. But again, it all depends on what you decide about appropriations to inflation proofing, because this assumes that they were done. If you didn't appropriate anything to inflation proofing, I'm pretty confident you would have been able to meet both the 4.5 and the 5. I'm not sure about this next one, which is somebody threw this out that I just kind of heard through the grapevine that somebody was interested in a 6% draw, so I went ahead and did that.
Not a finance member in the Senate.
No, nobody in this room. This might have been the House. I don't know. So I just figured you might as well see the other end of the spectrum. So 6% draw, you do get, at the end, you get about $1.2 billion more. So over the long run, I guess that's better if you like the draw. But you can see it was really rocky getting there. The ERA kicked in, I don't know, 12 of the 25 years. Half the time you were limited by the ERA if you have a 6% draw. So punchline, you know, the bigger the draw, the more the ERA is going to come in and take the draw away from you, because it's designed to limit how much comes out of the fund and to protect the corpus. All right. We're not recommending a 6% draw. I thought this was kind of interesting. I went ahead, I had some, you know, because I've had this model, I'm able to kind of look at what now would look like under, for some various variables, under all of these scenarios. So right now we're sitting, this is at the end of 2025, we're sitting on $85 billion of the value of the permanent fund. Under the 4.5% draw, you'd only have $71 billion. Under the 5% draw, you'd have 68, and under the 6% draw, you'd have 66. Those numbers would actually be further apart, except the ERA stopped you from spending more than you could. So one that I find interesting is what would have been the 2025 distribution, right? So under right now, you get a $3.6, $3.7 billion distribution. If you'd been paying out 4.5% the whole time, it'd be a $2.7 billion distribution. So the fact that you only paid out 2.5% for the first, you know, life of the fund before 2018 is what allows you to pay out $3.6, $3.8 billion, which is what the state needs. If you'd been paying that out all along, you wouldn't have a high enough market value where you apply 5% to it and you get what you need, right? So kudos to everyone who managed to not spend that money, because it's really coming in handy now.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Make sure I'm understanding, or maybe just it's been around the Capitol long enough to try and think of what devious things someone else might do. In this scenario, with the two accounts, you get around the ERA as a safety check by just not doing all the inflation proofing and keeping extra cash in there, right?
Yeah.
And then it's effectively not a safety check anymore, right? Am I missing something?
Yep. No, that's I'm not recommending.
Far less of a safety check, I would say.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Go ahead and continue. Oh, just one other quick thing to add. Just, I don't know if you got to notice, but we've had one member here. How many years?
A few.
Quite a few years.
3 years or so. But the other three of us have been at this finance table for 25 years.
So you've lived all this history that I'm showing.
Yeah.
So I've been working for the permanent fund since 89, so I've been around a little bit, too.
Okay. You'll go on to 36.
All right. So this, there's a lot of words on this page. Basically what I do is I've maintained this model for the permanent fund since about 1996. It's a Monte Carlo simulation model to sort of help them understand the potential future outcomes for all the important variables for the fund. It's driven by our capital market expectations, so the same numbers that you saw in that second section. I'm able to kind of overlay those, not only the returns, but the risks, and the asset allocation in the permanent fund, fire it off, it goes out 10 years in the future and kind of tells us what might happen. And unfortunately, the past, I can kind of give you what would have happened exactly. In the future, I can just give you a range. I can't tell you what would have what's going to happen. If I could do that, we'd be rich. All right, so underlying this simulation, what these bars represent is the range of returns for the permanent fund in each year of the simulation for 10 years. So you can see that the dot in the middle is about the same every year, but they've got a pretty wide range. So we're saying there's a 5% chance that the return could be as high as 22%, and a 5% chance it could be as low as negative 7. I don't even show like what there's a 1% chance of, because that's pretty bad. Nobody wants to see that. So all right, so that's underlying what I'm going to show you. Those are the returns. Those are the total return for the fund. These are the statutory returns on the same scale. So I put them on the same scale purposely to show you that statutory net income, the thing that feeds the ERA, the realized gains, the coupons, the dividends, is a much more stable number. It's got a much narrower range in any given year than the return. All right. So the volatility does not necessarily find its way. The coupons are still getting paid, the dividends are still getting paid, and they're only realizing some of the losses in down years and some of the gains in up years. So that's the number right now that drives the ability to pay a dividend or to pay a draw. Okay. So that's all I wanted to get across for those. This is our projections for the range of the distribution. So if you just kind of want to know with the current 5% draw formula what the draw is going to look like for the next 10 years, it's this middle line right here. It starts at 3.8, which we know about. We know that it's supposed to be 4 in 2027 based on the ending market value in 2025. And then it starts to have some variation when you get into 28, 29. But the variation is pretty narrow. It gets wider. And the reason that the variation is narrow is because the 5-year average only changes by 1 year every year. There's 4 years that were the same as the previous year. So the draw is actually, you know, pretty tight. Even if you have a big market value drop, it doesn't have a huge effect on the draw. It's not until you get all those 5-year that we already know out of your 5-year average that you start to see a big divergence from the worst to the best. I overlay this range of distributions. Now I'm going to show you statutory net income in dollars. So kind of keep your eye on where those bars are, because I'm going to throw some new bars up. Boom. So I'll just do this back and forth just because I think it illustrates what I want to show you. There's what statutory net income generates. There's the draw. Statutory net income, the draw. And I keep the black dots the same. So my point being that statutory net income under the current structure of the fund most of the time should be able to cover the draw. So that's an important point. All right. This is the range of inflation-proofing appropriations that I've projected. So the way I do the model is I look at the balance in the ERA, I take the draw. If there's anything left after the draw, then I do the inflation proofing. But if the inflation, if the draw eats up everything in the ERA, then we don't do the inflation proofing. And so this is what takes the brunt of the volatility in those down markets is inflation proofing. You can see that if I go back to the draw, in pretty much every year, there's not even a 5% chance of a zero draw. Here, when we get out into 2032 or 2031, the inflation proofing is zero in the 75th percentile. So there's a 25% chance with a 5% draw that you're going to run into a year where you're not going to be able to inflation proof. All right. This is the range of market values. So if we hang right there in the middle, we should pass $100 billion in 2032. We've had a pretty fabulous second half of the fiscal year. First half of the fiscal year, and so far this coming into this year, I think we were at $92 billion, I think, yesterday or the day before. So closer than I would have thought, by now based on this projection. Principal balance, just so mechanics-wise, you know what drives the difference between the top and the bottom is inflation. These really high principal balances is because they got a high inflation regime, and you just put a whole bunch of money into principal using the inflation proofing. All right. So I think this is an important slide, actually, and I almost wish I didn't put the 6% draw numbers on here. But these are the median expected draws for the 4.5%, 5%, and 6% case. I ran all three of these through this future projection model, and this is the midpoint. And the point I want to make about this slide is that you see the blue line, the blue bars are the 4.5% draw. And, of course, they're going to be lower than the 5% draw. All right? But the blue bars are catching up. By the time you get to 2035, they're not that far apart. And if you take this out to about 2037, they're going to be equal. And then after that, the 4.5% draw is going to be more dollars than the 5% draw. And the reason for that is because you're leaving a little bit of extra money in the fund, and the fund is growing, and pretty soon 4.5% of a bigger fund is bigger than 5% of a smaller fund. So if you can hold on at a smaller draw, you'll actually be able to pay out more in the future than you will under a 5% draw. So I think that's just an important, if you're thinking about the future generations, if you have the patience, eventually a draw that's more sustainable is going to result in a higher draw in the future in dollars. Any questions? All right. So the rest of these charts just sort of show you the difference in the range of outcomes. So this is the distribution. You know, obviously the 6% draw is going to have the highest median distribution, but it has the lowest worst case. So that just shows you that the higher the draw, it introduces volatility, it interacts badly with the ERA, and then you have the worst case of a $1.1 billion draw. It's 2.1 under the 4.5%. All right. Statutory net income, this kind of gets to that crossover point that I talked about. The 6% draw out in 2035 is going to have the lowest statutory net income because there's less money, and it can't earn as much yield. All right. Market value. So, you know, if a 4.5% draw, this is, again, the middle, and this is 10 years out, you'll have $114 billion in the fund. 6% draw, you'll have $100 billion in the fund. And that's why you can't pay out as much, because you just don't have as much money. All right. Principal balance isn't majorly affected by this, so I'll skip that. This chart, 49, simply I just took the probability of not being able to make the inflation proofing. That's at the bottom, and the probability of not being able to make the full draw. Again, probabilities are higher under the 6% than they are under the 4.5%, no surprise. And then I have two more charts, and then I'm done. So there was, at some point, I overheard somebody talking about somebody suggesting that if you have a 5% draw, you should put a rule on there where if the fund hadn't earned 5%, you can't pay out 5%. It seems like a natural kind of a limiter rule. I mean, the ERA kind of does that for you, but this would be on, you know, maybe on top of the one account system. So I was curious just back in history what that would look like. When would that have been a limiter, and what would be a good structure for a rule like that? So what I did here is I said, here are the fund returns in these columns. The first column is the one-year return, ended 6/30/95 in this case. Then the three-year, then the five-year, then the 10-year. And I essentially highlight all of the cells where the return is below 5%. So if you said, I only want to pay either 5% or whatever the fund earned over the previous 5 years, if it's lower, the red cells would be what you could pay out with a 5% nominal return, five-year return limiter. So the takeaway from this is if you're going to come up with a limiting rule like this, the longer the time horizon, the less it's going to kick in. So these numbers are a lot less volatile over here, and there would have only been 2 years where you wouldn't have been able to pay a 5% if you had a rule like this. All right, so the last slide, though, this is 5% nominal. This is 5% real. So this just goes to show you that if you're going to have a rule where you can only pay out if the fund is, it has to have earned 5% real over the previous 10 years or you can't pay that full amount out, because that's such a hard bogey, there's going to be a lot of years where you wouldn't be able to pay a full draw. So
it hasn't come from this table.
Okay.
So I don't know what room it came out of, but certainly wasn't sent to finance, which is good to know, I think, to counter that particular argument or proposal put on the table by somebody that doesn't have much experience in the finance world.
Yeah.
They won't be here making those decisions.
Okay. All right, that concludes our presentation.
I appreciate you guys putting this presentation together and then bringing it to our attention, because this has been a discussion at the table, and we're in the process now of some consultation with individual members to see kind of what their thoughts are to put together a proposed statutory change in the table. But we've got more work. The chairmans have more work to do with committee members before that surfaces, and this is part of the background, so it's very helpful. Do we have other questions? We want to back up Senator Keel. You want to back up to that earlier position, or?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think we got a pretty thorough addressing.
Okay. And we might, depending on what kind of proposal comes out on the table here the next few weeks, we might need some consultation from you, from Callan, on that.
We're happy to help.
The other concern that we have at the table is dealing with the Department of Revenue and their previous commissioner and his lack of following his fiduciary obligations. And it's a very serious situation. And I'm wondering what type of consultations Callan has, if any, with the Department of Revenue and the commissioner.
Through the chair, Steve Center from Callan. Clearly, we work with the Department of Revenue as it relates to the Alaska Retirement Management Board, right, and the DB and the DC plans. We do not work with the Department of Revenue when it comes to the CBR or any of the other asset pools that they manage outside of. They do manage a pool for the mental health trust that we consult on, but we don't work on the CBR, or we're not involved in that decision that was made.
Right, and I understand that, and I just I guess the concern some of us has is the lack of guidance for any particular commissioner to help them not go astray. So I recognize that the commissioner is on several of these boards, or his, you know, point person. So they do have the knowledge of the capital markets and expectations derived from the mental health group, permanent fund group, the pension group. So we'll be working on that situation at the table, trying to work with the administration on how what kind of system should be in place so this doesn't happen again. It's pretty difficult if a commissioner intentionally goes around the Department of Law and intentionally circumvents his obligation. That's challenging. So we'll be working on that over the next couple months to see if we can't come to some form of a structure, a little more formal for the department or the commissioner of revenue, to make sure the future commissioner revenues don't fall into the same scenario. So I just thought I'd mention that to you. I know you guys are probably well aware of it. It's frankly embarrassing for professional groups and companies and individuals that work with the state to have something like this take place, because we're dealing with billions of dollars here all the time. So anyway, I know you guys aren't interested in jumping in that bonfire, and I don't blame you.
Thank you.
We have other questions, concerns? Okay. We may have a request for some scenarios run or something like that, depending on what the committee members want to have done after the meeting. I'll try to get with them, or Senator Hoffman, or Senator Olson, or some form, so we kind of get an idea what each member is thinking, and we'll try to come up with something. Senator Hoffman.
Well, I'd like to thank this committee. We've had problems with the Department of Revenue in the past as it relates to the investments of the Power Cost Equalization Fund, and we've taken that away from the Department of Revenue and placed that with the Pern Fund Corporation, and that has worked well for the endowment.
We have a little laundry once in a while to hang out on the line, you know. But we do appreciate the permanent fund stepping in and managing the Power Cost Equalization Fund, and we have a lot of confidence in the permanent fund board and Cowan as the consultant, and you have decades of experience with the state. The proof is in the pudding when we look at the performance results and the standout that you had mentioned earlier. Nationally, there's no other state that's in the position in Alaska, not even close.
Not even close.
And we want to continue that.
One, I may be through the chair speaking out of school, but in looking at other sovereign wealth funds, there's this constant tension between running it solely for the purpose of generating total return per unit of risk, like a fiduciary standard, and turning it into an economic development fund and funding projects in Alaska. And I know there's a lot of pressure on everyone in your position because it's easy for people to say, why not just invest it in Alaska, or why not create a mandate where it has to invest in Alaska, or why not commit $1 billion to a pipeline? In my experience of 35 years of looking at this, you can't serve two masters with a fund like this. So anything you guys can do to protect the permanent fund from that type of influence is going to be better for the state of Alaska, I think, in the long run. So,
there was a – appreciate that comment. There was a also a comment by the reference by the mental health board when we discussed the mental health board, and they moved their payout from, I think, 4.25 to 4.5, and they were talking about the balance of current needs of Department of Mental Health, I don't want to call them shareholders, but they're beneficiaries, and then the future growth of the fund. Mm-hmm. And there was they said that they it was recommended to them that they move to the 4.5 from 4.25 to better balance those two masters.
Right.
And I was wondering if you had any comments or anything you want to say about that dealing with the permanent fund, because it seems like it's very similar. Future Alaskans that aren't even born yet to the current folks that are here today.
Through the chair, Steve Center from Cowan. I do consult on the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Cowan recently conducted what's called an asset spending study for the Mental Health Trust to help them determine what a sustainable draw rate would be for the Mental Health Trust. You are correct that it was 4.25 up until, I believe, they just made the change for 2025. Our recommendation was to increase that payout to 4.5. When we initially did our study for them, we actually recommended an even higher payout, a 4.75% payout. We did pull that down to 4.5% for our final recommendation, and that is because, yes, the Mental Health Trust invests in the permanent fund. They have $800-ish million, I want to say, in the permanent fund. They also have substantial land assets, and the land assets generate income, and that income also is spendable. But that is not part of the 4.5% draw that we ultimately can help them come to. So it's just important to remember that it's not quite apples to apples with the permanent fund. It's like an apple and a pear. They're related. and the permanent fund makes up a good portion of their draw, but they do have income coming from outside of the permanent fund as well. So just another thing to keep in mind.
As is the state.
Any other questions, comments before we finish up this morning? Okay. Well, thank you for coming and helping the Finance Committee. We appreciate it. The next meeting will be this afternoon, where we'll hear from the Office of Management and Budget on the supplemental budget. I think there's an amendment or two or a couple of changes and updates. So please have let our other colleagues know around the building so they pay attention to this meeting. It'll be, I think, fairly informative and important. And we are adjourned at 10:35. Well, we'll go by this clock. 10:35. We are adjourned.